Coming up today, drone dilemmas, Silicon Valley sexism, and we look back on Pokemon Go, 1 year after it turned millions of people into weird Pikachu-hunting zombies. You're listening to episode 325 of the WideUK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Turk.
Hi.
And Oliver Franklin Wallace.
Hello.
There was an awkward pause there because I previously introduced Vicky Turk as Vicky Wollaston, who is no longer of this parish. Sorry. Facts. Vicky, you can go first.
Great. I have a great science fact this week. So this week, CERN discovered a new particle.
Yay.
How exciting. And it's especially charming. That was a physics pun. Because this particle is a baryon, which means it's made up of three quarks. And what's special about it is two of those quarks are of the charm flavour. So it's the first particle to be found that has two heavy quarks. Because the charm type of quark is a type of heavy quark.
Now this fact brings up a whole lot of follow-up questions, which I won't ask because I can already tell you look slightly afraid, such as what's a quark, what's a baryon, why are some heavy?
You need to go do particle physics 101, get your particle physics for dummies.
Exactly.
But then throw that textbook away, because CERN has discovered so many new fundamental particles and interesting observations in the last kind of three years that all of the textbooks are now out of date.
We know so little. We are ignorant and blind in the dark. But it's really exciting, these kind of breakthroughs. Yeah. We just don't quite understand what they mean yet.
Well, so this is kind of predicted by the standard model, so it's not like a huge shock or anything, but it is the first time that they've actually managed to find them. So it's nice to kind of say, yep, standard model is correct there. And it might also help us to understand a bit better the force that binds quarks together, which is still a little bit of a mystery. And it has a very unpronounceable name. It's something like GCC++? Something like that.
Okay, cool.
Of course.
Yeah, well, luckily we have a couple of very good scientific experts on the Wired editorial team who are able to demystify all of this and make the unexplainable explainable. Ollie, what did you learn this week?
My favourite fact of the week is a number. It is 30,000, which is the number of homes in southern Australia that are going to be powered by Tesla's new mega battery. This is what Tesla are calling the biggest battery in the world. It is a 129 megawatt hour array, and it's going to be made up of their storage packs. So that's an interesting move by Tesla. It's been a big week for batteries if you're a battery nerd like me. There's a German company called Ewa Gaspeicher has announced that it's building the world's largest flow battery, which is going to be in a cave in a salt mine in near Berlin. So
great.
It's been a big week for battery nerds.
Yeah, if you want to go down the pub with someone and just talk about batteries,
then I'm your man.
Ollie is available for hire. I learned about the biro. I had one in my hand and I thought, curious little thing. Wonder how that came into being. I imagine this is probably quite well known, but I didn't know it. In 1938, a Hungarian newspaper journalist, Laszlo Biro, noticed that the ink used on his printing presses dried quickly, and so he tried to use it in a fountain pen to avoid the problem of leaks, blots, and smudges, and thus invented the biro that we all know and love today. Yep, see?
Well done him.
Yeah, stunned silence.
I'm excited by biros.
Yeah, you kind of take them for granted.
A bit like batteries, really.
I do.
Yeah, except for when they're in caves.
Are you a Bic biro kind of guy?
Now, what's this biro? This is a Micron biro. Never heard of them before. And yet it's in my hand.
Well, there you go.
Biros. Our first story this week. on Sunday afternoon here in the UK at Gatwick Airport, which is one of the biggest and busiest airports in the country, a drone was seen flying nearby the runway. This caused five flights to be redirected to other UK airports. Lots of disruption and delays. Vicky, you were on one of the flights. It caused chaos.
I wasn't actually redirected, but I was delayed. Yep, I was trying to get back from Northern Ireland. I was at a wedding and unfortunately, just had to have another pint of Guinness in the airport while
it's
I was
tough,
waiting.
Tough life. Yeah. So we say chaos, not really chaos, but it is remarkable that something as big and busy and important as an airport can be shut down by someone flying a tiny little electronic thing nearby it. When you think of the size of a drone compared to the size of a massive Boeing 747, shouldn't really be a contest. But it turns out that these things are pretty concerning. So you might think, drones. But actually, the amount of incidents involving them is still quite small, and we don't really know what damage that they'll cause if they were to hit. And, to put them in comparison with birds, geese, swans, name a bird, starlings, mainly big birds, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, a goldfinch probably wouldn't do a huge amount of damage.
No, we're not talking about blue tits. We're talking about robins. Sad. Yeah, we're talking about big geese. So I spent a few thrilling hours this week looking into the problem of drones versus birds and what we can possibly learn from the aviation industry's response to birds as to how it might respond to drones. So the International Civil Aviation Organization reported 65,139 bird strikes between 2011 and 2014.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. Figures for drones are a bit more difficult to come by, but there are only 138 reported incidents involving drones and civil aircraft in the UK in that period, so between 2011 and 2014. So you've got 65,139 worldwide, admittedly, versus 138 in the UK. So even if you kind of grow that number out to the entire planet, it's still quite a small issue. But I spoke to an engineering expert at... it was Philippa Oldham, head of transport and manufacturing in the Institution of Mechanical Engineers here in London, and I wanted to find out what's being done to understand the complexities of modelling drone impacts. And here's what she had to say.
So, I mean, obviously, if you think of a drone, it's obviously got lots of different mechanical parts, and whether it be, you know, the electronics, whether it be the fittings that are putting it all together, and the fact that it has moving parts itself. So, yeah, so that's exactly it in terms of what they're trying to model of what how it will impact it. Because as it goes through, say, an engine, it's obviously mulched up, if you like, or broken down within the engine. So that damage, again, will impact or damage the engine as it goes through and almost gets rejected out of the engine. So that's the challenge of how much it breaks up as it goes through the engine and the damage that it does. And again, that'll have an impact in terms of how it hits, you know, whether it hits it head on, whether it hits it at a 25 or 45 degree angle, whether it's going really fast, how heavy it is. So, yeah, all these contribute to the impact and the devastation that it could cause.
So there's a number of points in there that I found quite interesting. It's mainly the complexity, the angle, how the drone breaks down as it goes through. And because we spent so much longer modelling so-called bird strikes on planes, we've got a much better idea of what might happen. But with a drone, there are arguably more variables. You can kind of say that a goose will probably be of a certain size. It's got bones, it's got blood, it's got guts. Whereas a drone, well, yeah, it's got electronics, it's got batteries, but there's a lot more research still to be done, and we're still quite early on in our understanding of this. And also, we haven't ever really had an incident where a drone has gone into an aircraft engine and caused damage. So the main concern here is that they might be distracting, they might hit a part of the cockpit, they might smash into the window, and it might be off-putting for the pilots, which is why there's so much fear around them. So that was interesting for me anyway. And there's a separate part to this, of course, is that drones aren't just being used to, you'd imagine in this case, maybe capture cool footage or just as a bit of a dare. They're also being used, and we were talking about this a little bit off microphone, Ollie, they're being used to smuggle stuff into prisons.
Oh, yeah. Drones are a massive problem for prison populations in the UK and US and pretty much everywhere now. We were just discussing off mic during that clip that a prison in Guernsey earlier this year became the first prison, I think worldwide, to institute a technological solution. It has a drone defense system to signal block, to jam any drones trying to carry drugs or illegal contraband into the prison, because there have been quite a number. I think there's kind of a few incidents of this every week at prisons across the UK, so it's a huge problem that people are trying to deal with.
Yeah, and they've actually managed to come up with a solution, and there's other options I know about firing nets at drones, about using lasers, about all sorts of clever things that might come along in the future, maybe more of military applications for some of those. But one of the points that Philippa made to me, and it was quite an obvious and easy one, is obviously you can't tell a bird not to fly, but you can tell a drone not to fly. So at the moment, we're kind of relying on the Civil Aviation Authority's drone code, which says that you have to fly a drone within a plane line of sight, that you have to be, you can't be within a certain distance of certain sites and certain buildings and crowds of people, etc., etc. But there's nothing to stop, apart from the law, someone from flouting those rules. And obviously, a lot of people might not really understand exactly what they are, although you'd hope if they're flying them under where planes are taking off and landing at Gatwick that they'd realise that's maybe not a particularly good idea. So there's a chance in the future that if this becomes a problem that gets worse and worse, as you'd imagine it might, as more people buy drones, that we'll end up using similar systems to what's being pioneered at Guernsey, potentially around airfields, places like Buckingham Palace, the Houses of Parliament, just to stop people from being able to fly them. Well, obviously it's a lot more complicated because you can't just use a signal jammer, because there's all sorts of signals, particularly at an airport or a military facility or something like that.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting solutions that I've seen talked about in the industry is the idea of doing something at a hardware level. So being able to put in kind of geo blocks, which means that they actually just won't work if they sense that they're within certain spaces. Obviously, that's quite controversial because people don't like being told that they can't use the technology that they own in certain places. It brings in all kind of rights issues. But with a lot of these companies being, you know, you have companies like DJI, which are selling a large number of the drones on the market. I know that there are discussions between some of the aviation authorities in the US and here and in China as to other ways that you could get around this. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the coming few years.
Yeah.
It's so annoying, isn't it? Because it's clearly just a few people who are being a bit stupid and mm-hmm. flying drones where you're obviously not supposed to. I mean, you know, flying a drone near an airport is just, it's just common sense that you shouldn't really do that.
Yeah, and the potential level of damage here, I mean, it's difficult to say, but let's compare. So a fully grown male Canada goose weighs 6.5 kilograms. A DJI Phantom 4 weighs 1.3 kilograms. So obviously, there's a big difference in size there. Geese fly in flocks. Drones tend not to fly in flocks, but geese don't have lithium-ion batteries and explode. Drones do and could. So there's a number of things to consider here. And if you were to have a larger drone or potentially a drone that has a deliberate payload that's flying into an aircraft as it's taking off or landing, you could cause quite a bit of damage. So to look at birds again, in January 2009, a flight taking off from LaGuardia Airport in New York City hit a flock of Canada geese just a couple of minutes after it took off. It lost all power and had to ditch. There's very, very memorable photographs, and there was a film made about it as well, I think, right?
Called Sully. Yeah.
Yeah. About it having to ditch in the Hudson River right in the middle of Midtown Manhattan. No serious injuries, but a very, very dramatic incident. And there's a possibility that there's not a lot to stop people from using drones as weapons or just from using them in irresponsible ways. So things like Ollie was saying with geo-blocking or signal jamming might have to be things that are introduced in the future. I mean, just the disruption. Vicky, you're only delayed by an hour and had to have an extra pint, which doesn't sound too bad. But there were some people that were meant to land in London and ended up landing like 3 hours later in Bournemouth and then had to get back to London. It's just an inconvenience, but it's not great when you're one of the world's busiest airports. So it was another example of drones causing mischief, and you'd imagine that the legislation's going to have to change at some point.
Well, it's going to have to change because Silicon Valley's kind of recently become obsessed with what some people call flying cars, but basically personal, person-sized UAVs or drones. You look at companies like Lilium and various others. One of the Alphabet companies is working on kind of mobility person-sized drones. And you know, when Elon Musk at TED was talking about this and why he thinks that flying cars are never going to happen, as he described it, if you have lots of these things flying above your head willy-nilly, that's not a stress-free situation. So I think that it's going to be interesting to see how the regulations play out here, because that's going to have a big impact when you start seeing kind of larger drones coming into play over the next few years.
Yeah.
It is interesting as well how we see things differently, because obviously, you know, drones are presented as this like brand new thing, but people were flying hobbyist remote control planes long before the word drone was used in that context.
That's really true.
And I know that community is actually like very annoyed really with the, kind of new media spotlight, which is often painting a negative picture on hobbyist flyers.
But maybe with that, there was such a higher barrier to entry that they're much more difficult to fly. They were much more expensive. You didn't really get them in like your standard little gadget shops on the high street.
Yeah, I guess it was maybe more of a niche hobby.
Maybe so.
There were just fewer of these kind of incidents.
Yeah. Whereas now you can go into, so in the UK we have a shop called Argos, or you go into Tesco's or Sainsbury's, the big supermarkets. You can just buy a drone for £100. And you wouldn't necessarily be the sort of person that's very conscientious about flying it in a safe way. A bit like hoverboards, right? Hoverboards. When they became a bit of a thing. In fact, I saw someone still whizzing down a street in London on the road on one the other day. So people will use new technology in irresponsible ways if given half a chance.
So if you are a Wired listener, do check out the Civil Aviation Authority's guidelines on this because basically... Like, don't delay our planes.
Fly safe,
people.
Travel
a lot. It's really annoying. Fly safe.
Our second story this week is an awful lot more complicated and an awful lot more depressing. So in Silicon Valley this week, several venture capitalists have been accused of sexism and sexual harassment by women within the tech industry. There's a whole raft of allegations. And Vicky Turk, you've been looking into this week.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, sexism in tech is... an unfortunately old and very well-known theme. But yes, there's been a couple of stories that have broken in the past week or so that have really cast a spotlight on this issue. So back in June, The Information published a story in which about half a dozen women, female entrepreneurs, founders of startups, claimed that a VC called Justin Kolbeck, who was at Binary Capital, had made unwanted advances towards them while discussing business. And I think this was a particularly strong story, not just because they spoke about the instance, but because they put names to it. They put their names, they put his name. And as a result, Kolbeck resigned, as did others on his team. And then about a week later, another story was published in the New York Times. This was by Katie Benner. And she writes that she spoke to more than two dozen women in the startup scene about being sexually harassed, of which 10 of them named their harassers, often providing corroborating messages and emails. And she also put some names in that article. Two of the VCs named are Dave McClure of 500 Startups and Chris Sacker of Lowercase Capital. And there are others, too. So yeah, it's just really sort of bringing these stories out in much more detail than you usually hear. We often hear about sexism in tech in a kind of quite vague way. You know, it's just part of the bro culture. Everyone knows it's an issue. But these are really sort of highlighting the real events that take place if you're a woman in the scene.
What we have here, for not the first time, but it's a rare occurrence of it happening, Uber maybe being a good recent example as well, is of women coming out and saying, this is the person that did it, this is what they did, and enough of them doing it so that they have sort of the strength of their message. It can't be dismissed, it can't be ignored. And this has turned into, you might not have heard about it much in the UK or Europe, but this has been an absolutely huge story in Silicon Valley that's led to some very, very prominent people being called out.
Yeah. And we should say that, so Chris Sacker, one of the VCs who's mentioned in the New York Times story, an entrepreneur, Susan Wu, claims that he propositioned her and behaved inappropriately. Now, since publication, he has said that he disputes that account. As for some of the other incidents, one that has been getting a lot of attention is Dave McClure at 500 Startups. So Sarah Kunst, also an entrepreneur, reported that when she went for a job with the firm, she was sent an inappropriate message by him. And when she discussed this with one of his colleagues, the company ended conversations with her. So suggesting really that, you know, this actually had an impact on the business that she was doing. 500 Startups says that after an internal investigation, Dave McClure is no longer in charge of day-to-day operations with them. And there are plenty of other stories involving various people, including sexist comments during fundraising, sexual messages being sent, and in some cases, harassment such as groping and unwanted advances.
Yeah, so it's really, really damning stuff, and it really felt like it needed saying. And it's it's a good thing that now this conversation is happening an awful lot more out in the open, and hopefully more people will have the courage to come forward and more people will feel that they can no longer behave in this way, particularly in Silicon Valley. There does seem to be, from reading the reports, that it's just seen as acceptable behavior. And they felt like, well, that's just the way to behave. Some of the apologizing on Twitter and on Medium posts was, it was just Dave being Dave. It was just blokes being blokes, which is no defense.
Yeah, it just doesn't cut it, really, does it?
It's kind of the text version of the it was just locker room talk. I think what's depressing, particularly about it, for me and for kind of everyone who's been covering this industry for some time, is that we had the Susan Fowler incident, Uber, which has led to Travis Kalanick stepping down. It took weeks for that for Susan Fowler's blog post to have the effect that it ended up doing. And it was only really when a huge critical mass took hold that this actually made any difference in any change. And it's taken a real effort by the community to shame these companies into doing something. And it just shows that the internal review processes, the HR departments, there are failures at every level. And this is something that's been going on for years, for as long as I've been working on it Wired. It's kind of like a known secret. Everyone talks about it. And it's taken this long for people to be discussing it openly.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most damning things as well, is that several of these women, you know, say that they did report this to someone. They mentioned it to the company, or they spoke to colleagues of the person that they were talking to. And, you know, nothing happened, or they were shut out. So it's not that, you know, women haven't tried to fight back against this issue. It's that their voices haven't been heard, or they've been heard but just dismissed. And so, yeah, I think that's what makes these stories powerful, is that taking it public seems like the only way that you can battle against this machine.
Is there another thing in play here? And we were talking about it in the office earlier this week, but within a company culture, and this obviously massively failed at Uber and other places that we've heard about, there should be a line of reporting that if someone was to say something sexually inappropriate, then you go to a line manager, you go to HR, you take it up the chain of command, and there should be systems in place. Those systems weren't in place at Uber. But for venture capitalists, there's a whole different power relationship at play. And some of the accusations have been around sort of, I don't know whether to invest in your company or hit on you. I don't know, you know, kind of sexual suggestion of saying, I'll do you a favor if you do me a favor. I think there was one person who wrote that a venture capitalist wouldn't leave her flat very late at night, saying that, oh, well, maybe you could just sleep with me just once. Yeah. And she was married, and I believe he was married. Certainly she was.
Not that makes any difference.
No, not that it makes any difference. But there's a different power dynamic at play, and maybe this was the only way for that to be called out.
Yeah, so I think it's not so clear cut. It's, you know, it's not an employer-employee relationship, which is sort of easier to see how the people relate to each other, and perhaps easier to report. You know, you've got a chain of command, you've got an HR system, even if they're not very good. Whereas, yeah, the VC-founder relationship is a little bit different. Obviously, the common thread is that a VC has a lot of power over the people who are coming to them for investment. And that's where these kind of relationships and these kind of incidents get particularly dodgy.
Yeah, and I really should have looked up the numbers before coming in to record this, but maybe someone else knows off the top of their head. But the venture capitalist scene worldwide is overwhelmingly male, like hugely male. So you already have this quite strange power dynamic, but you also have almost an inevitability as a female entrepreneur that you're going to be pitching to a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have this problem in the Valley, but even here in the UK, if you did a quick summary look at the partners at the top 10 UK VC firms, they are overwhelmingly, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but from experience, I would say at least 3/4 male at the partner level. And, you know, we've seen this within companies with boards, and we've seen this within companies at lower levels when there's been harassment or discrimination at lower levels, and the challenge, as you said, of like reporting things up the chain of command, which is, if every single person above you in the chain of command is a guy, they're going to, and you know, they are taking this locker room talk approach to behavior, then nothing's going to get done.
He's just being a bloke. kind of thing. So will anything
just,
change?
Just to listeners, if you are one of those dudes, that's just it's just not on. That's just like not a defense, because I feel like there is a, you know, Wired is part of the tech community, and there's been a great outpouring of sympathy and activism around this week, but there's also been the inevitable people jumping to the defense of some of the accused, or making some totally outrageous and slanderous claims about some of the women coming forward. It's just not on.
Yeah, it really isn't. And hopefully this week can start to make it very clear to everyone that this kind of thing isn't on. But I was about to say, will anything change, do you think, Vicky?
Well, I think, you know, these stories are a good start. And I think the courage of these women to come forward may also encourage other women to come forward and, you know, just shed light on the issue, because it's hard to deal with especially specific problems or people or organizations if you don't know about them. And I think, you know, within the community, there's lots of people talking to each other, and, you know, there probably are things that people know, but no one says. So if it encourages people to come forward, then that's sort of a first step. But obviously it is only a first step. Knowing about the problem is not solving the problem, and that's a lot harder. And part of it is obviously the broader cultural issue. It's not only in tech that women are discriminated against or face sexist attitudes. It's the fact that, as you say, you know, tech is predominantly male dominated. And the more that these incidents happen, the more that that's going to be perpetuated.
Yeah.
So really it is on the companies and organizations and the people that work within them to make solid steps to change their attitudes, make practical steps to change their systems, and really to, you know, do more than just sympathise on Twitter.
Yeah, to turn sympathy into real definable steps for delivering change. So we've kind of danced around it a little bit, but it would be useful, I think, to end this discussion by talking about how things can get better, what things need to change if we're going to start to tackle this issue.
I mean, on an individual level, obviously just changing attitudes, it's easier said than done and requires a certain amount of introspection and self-awareness. But that's something that people can do on a personal level, and just really look at themselves and think, and look at your colleagues and call them out if they're doing things that you don't think are quite right. On a sort of more of a company level thing, Susan Fowler, who obviously brought to light a lot of the sexism that she experienced while working for Uber earlier this year. She came up with a few suggestions of, you know, solid things that workplaces can do. And one of those is ending things like non-disparagement agreements and strict workplace confidentiality agreements that stop people talking out if they've experienced problems like this.
Yeah.
And that's obviously one reason why a lot of people may be put off from talking about discrimination, is because, you know, they can't. They've signed the right to do that away. Obviously training, putting in place proper training against sexism, against unconscious bias, you know, to educate people and help them think about what they're doing, that can help a lot. And really acting on information.
Yep.
I mean, that is the most frustrating thing for me, is that whenever these stories come out, it's clear that people knew about this all along, and not just the person who was harassed and the harasser, but other people. You know, they tend to be these kind of unsaid secrets. And so when someone brings that information forward, the onus really is on the organisation in question to do something with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a number of people who were speaking, writing about this week, who said that they had reported things, nothing had happened, and then they just felt scared to take it any further. They felt powerless. They felt... Mm. You know, where did they have further recourse to do anything about this? And I suppose, finally, as someone who's, it's a business of relationships between entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and people trying to make their business a success. And you can't really afford, you might think in your head, to ruffle too many feathers and to do too many things to give you a bad reputation. This is a woman. Whereas actually, it's the people who are doing the really, really horrible things to you that are ruffling the feathers and they're getting the bad reputation. And finally, they're getting called out on it. And hopefully that can really start to change things.
I'll just add one thing to that, which is to any listeners in the VC or investment community, because I think the power dynamic is really crucial in a lot of these cases. And you know, social psychologists have recommended that one way of removing unconscious bias in, for example, in job interviews, is to have two separate panels or two separate groups doing the interviews, so that if there are biases in either an individual or elsewhere, that person's biases don't kind of overtake the others. And I do think that it's about having other voices within the conversation. So when you're doing deals, partners need to have a review process of the kind of deals that they're signing somewhere in their organization, somewhere high up. You need to take ownership of the kind of deals that you're signing and look for evidence of this kind of behavior and act upon it. Because I think unless people are being reviewed on the kind of ways that they deal with other people, unless they're seeing it, unless they're being judged by it by their peers, then there's not really any reason for them to change their behavior. So I'm hoping that obviously the tech community will kind of look at themselves and change some of this behavior, but also the investment community and banking and all of the other areas that support the tech community and the startup community can start having a real think about piloting some of these ways to affect change, so that we're not reporting this story again in a couple of years' time, or, you know.
Yeah.
And we should say as well, you know, it's not just women. There are many other issues of discrimination in tech and in other sectors. You know, people are discriminated based on their sex and gender, but also based on their race, their sexuality, you know.
Yeah, it's straight white men and then a whole lot of problems caused by them. We're sure the problem isn't limited to Silicon Valley in the United States, and we are looking into sexism in London and the wider tech scene across the UK. We'd like to hear from you. Anyone who would like to share their thoughts and experiences, you can contact us. I'm james@wired.co.uk. Vicky, you are?
I'm vturk, V-T-U-R-K, @wired.co.uk.
And I'm Oli@wired.co.uk.
And of course, you can find all of us on Twitter as well. So do get in touch if you feel you have something to share. We'd be happy to hear from you. Our third story is a bit of a change of pace. Happy birthday.
A bit more lighthearted.
Happy birthday, Pokemon Go. 1 year ago, a couple of days ago, it first launched, I believe, just in Australia and New Zealand. But that didn't stop the whole world going Pokemad. It's a year later. I think we all played at the beginning. Does anyone still play? Put the hand up nice and high.
I still play.
Oh.
Do you guys not still play?
I played it once yesterday just because it was the anniversary and I wanted to see how it had changed.
And?
It was fun. I caught two new Pokemon that I don't think existed when I was playing.
Congratulations. So the thing that put me off, I can't remember how long through after the game coming out, I'm a bit of a Pokemon purist. And they had the original sort of Pokemon set, and I could remember most of the characters. And then they introduced, I'm not sure which Pokemon iteration it was, and they added a load more on top of it. And all of a sudden,
Silver and Gold, I think.
Yeah, all of a sudden you had all these weird ones, and I didn't really know what they were.
Yeah, the general rule of Pokemon like issues is that the Pokemon get worse and worse.
Yeah, so 1 to 151, solid Pokemon.
Yeah.
Beyond that,
once you enter the 300s, you're really struggling.
No idea what's going on there. No idea at all. Vicky Turk, you as well as spending this week on the very earnest task of sexism in the technology industry, you also spent far less time on Pokemon Go and trying to track down people who are still playing the game. Turns out quite hard.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great the first year anniversary of Pokemon Go to find out, you know, who still plays, like, what is the community like? Who are the people who are still Pokemon, as you say? And so I thought the first place I'd start is to reach out to the creators and moderators of Pokemon Go subreddits.
So like any good journalist, you went to Reddit.
Well, exactly.
And there was no story to be found.
These people were obviously interested enough in the game to take on an active role in the online community around it. So they must be big fans. Not necessarily the case. I reached out to lots of people. Five people came back to me very quickly, four of whom just said, you know, I don't really play anymore.
Yeah, and I think the reasons were maybe why an awful lot of people dropped off. Servers going down, updates to the game that they didn't agree with.
Yeah, so these were sort of in the early days of Pokemon Go. If you remember, I think it must have been within the first month or within the first few weeks, there were several issues which got people very riled up. One of those was, the server outages. You tried to log on and the servers were down, so you couldn't play. There was a very controversial tweak to the game early on regarding the tracking of Pokemon.
Scandal.
Don't know if you remember.
Scandal.
Yeah. So they used to show some little footprints to show how close you were to the Pokemon, and then it wasn't working, and then they just removed that feature. So, yeah, one person said, you know, he just wasn't interested in wandering around aimlessly trying to find Pokemon, and that ruined
Fair
it for
comment.
Him. One person said their phone just wasn't working well enough to play the game. Another said they were in rural Wales and, you know, there just weren't many Pokemon and Pokestops and things around. So these were all issues that were quite early on in the game.
Yeah, and the Mighty were always likely to fall. So at its peak, it was being played by 45 million people daily, which is just absolutely phenomenal. This game broke every single mobile game record out there and will likely hold those records for quite a long while. Yeah, and it's still, you know, it's still pretty popular, much as people want to kind of poop
on
it.
So yeah. This is the thing. You know, it's easy to say, oh, no one plays Pokemon Go anymore, but actually it's still an absolutely massive game. Obviously it's like still one of the most popular apps. There's still 65 million per month players, according to Niantic, which yeah, it's not bad at all. So although it's not the craze it once was, it does still have a firm fan base. And I did find a couple.
I think as well, it's really interesting in the impact that it's had on the wider kind of mobile gaming community. For example, my wife, who is not into video games at all, is an avid Pokemon Go player even now. She's
still
like 10 levels above me. It's intense. She talks about it on WhatsApp with her friends who are still playing it, which has kind of stunned me. But I remember at the time, everyone was kind of like, Pokemon Go, it's going to make augmented reality big. It's like the first AR breakout hit.
First thing I turned off was the AR.
Everyone just turned off the AR, and there's been no games like it ever since.
It's an absolute battery drain.
Maybe people just really like Pokemon. I don't know.
I couldn't play it for more than a few weeks because it just ate my data. I obviously wasn't on a good enough data plan to play.
Yes, it was a hungry game in terms of battery and phone resources and data and everything.
Which, for something that has like no graphics and no very little to actually do in the game, is pretty impressive.
It is impressive.
Absolutely destroying your GPS data.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was one story that you got from one of the Pokemon Go people that is still playing Pokemon Go, Vicky, that I really liked. And it was about the guy who had moved to London.
Oh, yeah.
And he was
yeah.
using it to explore the city, which I think is very sweet.
Yeah. He said he did take a kind of couple month hiatus, but he is still playing solidly now. He'd moved to London and found that it was a great way to explore the city, to go down kind of less trodden paths.
Get mugged.
Well, actually, that was mentioned.
Yeah, stay safe.
I can't remember who it was who mentioned this, but someone did say, yeah, the worst experience they had is people on mopeds trying to grab their phone when they're out
as you're walking along
Pokemon,
blindly.
Which is a problem in London and probably other big cities. He was using it that way. A couple of people I spoke to who still play regularly were really into Pokemon before Pokemon Go. So I think there is a real loyal fan base there of people who love Pokemon. Unsurprisingly,
they want to be the very
Pokemon
best.
Go. Exactly.
The best there ever was.
One of them still on a mission to catch a Mew, which doesn't even exist in the game yet, I don't think. It's
Good
one
luck.
Of the legendary Pokemon, which everyone is hoping Niantic will bring.
It will
back
appear
at
and there
point.
Will be stampedes of people that are still playing the game.
I still can't believe that you guys haven't played it since they reintroduced raid battles and all that. It's just a big update. It's like a totally different game.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe now.
Give it a second try.
The nicer weather. Definitely something that did make a difference was it came out in the UK in the summer, obviously because it's the summer now, and the weather is nice and you could wander around. Not so much fun to play during the British winter, which lasts for about 9 months of the year, when it's constantly rainy and windy and, you know, just not good Pokemon weather. So maybe now is the time, but probably not. You know, although Pokemon Go did help me find my now favourite pub in London when I was just aimlessly wandering the streets looking for Pokemon. I wouldn't have learned about that pub otherwise. So, yeah, I owe it a great debt. As our final item this week, a quiz, as we are now trying to make tradition. Today, Friday the 7th of July, would anyone like to take a guess of what day it is? What special occasion is it?
International Polar Bear Pup Day.
Polar Bear Pup Day. No, it's World Chocolate Day.
Oh, well, that's a lot
favorite
better.
Day.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know this.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's today. I didn't look that up. Maybe that's something for next week. So apparently there has to be a day for everything. Today is World Chocolate Day. In light of that, how much do you know about chocolate? Particularly obscure facts I was able to find while having a Google earlier this morning.
I eat a lot of chocolate. I'm not sure I know a lot about it.
Well, let's find out. In what year did Cadbury's make the world's first chocolate bar?
18-something.
You're
can I guess? Guess I like decade. 1873.
Okay.
I have no idea. 1827.
Ooh, who's closer? Goodness me. You said 73, you said 27. It's Vicky Turk. It's 1842.
Yes.
1842. I think that's the most extreme reaction someone's had to getting a quiz question right on this podcast yet. Okay, we're pumped. That's
I would love to see like all of the chocolate bar like iterations in a line, because these days chocolate bars just like shrink constantly, don't they? Because of like
Brexit, the Toblerone. Yeah.
I know, it's just a travesty. So just like, when did they just have like giant chocolate in the 19th century?
Probably, yeah. Although everyone was smaller in the past, so maybe it all evens out. What continent produces the most coca?
South America.
Africa.
Oliver Franklin Wallace. One all. Although originated, Vicky Turk, in Central and South America more than 4,000 years ago, now approximately 70% of the world's cocoa is grown in Africa. The Ivory Coast is the single largest producer, providing roughly 40% of the world's supply.
Nice.
Yeah, it's mostly West Africa. A single chocolate chip gives someone enough energy to walk how far? I'll accept the answer in meters or feet.
How big is the chocolate chip?
Just a standard, you know, like cookie chocolate chip.
Can I just ask how they've tested this? Have they just like starved someone for weeks?
Now walk.
Until they're totally immobile, giving them one chocolate.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. It must be like...
like 0.3019.
What?
Meters.
Meters. Okay.
Half a meter.
Yeah. If you went higher, you were gonna win. Yeah. It's 45 meters.
What?
Yeah. Or 150 feet.
This is calorific nonsense.
I have to say, I haven't verified.
I feel like I overeat a lot of chocolate.
Lot of those facts. So yeah, I mean,
I should be the world's greatest long distance walker.
Yep, that's not how that works. True or false? Cats are allergic to chocolate.
False.
I think false.
You probably should have disagreed. It's true.
Dear.
Chocolate contains coca, and coca contains the compound theobromine. Theobromine is toxic. Toxic. So when people say don't give chocolate to dogs,
same applies to cats. Dogs. Yeah, I suppose it would be.
And maybe horses. I'd have to look that up. So it's 2-1 to Vicky Turk going into the final question. There's no tiebreaker, so everyone wins if Holly gets this right. So chocolate is also toxic for humans, it turns out. But how much would it take to kill me? You can answer in pounds or kilograms.
That depends. Can I sharpen it first?
Sly. No. You just have to make me eat it.
Again, I can't help but feel like you would like vomit it all up before you died.
Yes,
is this like
theoretically.
Concentration is the compound. Presumably, it's a toxic compound within the mix.
Yes, yeah, so theobromine is present in all chocolate. Okay. It's a higher concentration, I think, in powdered chocolate, dark chocolate, certain kinds of chocolate. So there's a bit of a scale here. So I've got the amount in bars of a popular chocolate brand. But yeah, so I'm looking for 10 kilograms of dairy milk was the answer.
10 kilograms.
Yeah,
that's not that much.
No, it's about.
I could do it.
It's about 40
like
bars
over a Christmas period. You could do it.
Yeah,
40.
I think.
What size?
Yeah, no.
They must be the big ones to be 10 kilograms.
I think so. Yeah, I think you probably have to eat it all very quickly. So it was all in your system at the same time.
I think we should remind our readers to eat chocolate responsibly at this point.
Mm. As a bonus fact, on the other hand, one Smartie would be enough to kill a robin or a blackbird. One Smartie.
Also, eat Smarties responsibly.
Yeah, do not leave Smarties lying around. I should have used that as my fact at the beginning of the podcast. That's much better than something about biros. So I hope we've all learnt a lot. Yes? Good.
Yeah. I'm mostly just hungry now.
And warm. It is incredibly warm in our podcast cupboard. We'll leave it there for this week, and we'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.